picture a pharmacist in 1969, standing behind a counter in a small town in Ohio. A customer walks in with a prescription for amphetamines, diet pills, basically. The pharmacist fills it, no questions asked. Another customer wants barbiturates for sleep. Sure, here you go. Someone else wants a cough syrup with codeine. That'll be $2. There's no federal system governing any of this, no unified policy, just a patchwork of state laws, some stricter than others, and a growing sense that something has gone terribly wrong in America.
What do you mean, gone terribly wrong?
By the late 1960s, drug use had exploded across America. Not just marijuana on college campuses, though there was plenty of that, but heroin in the cities, LSD in the counterculture, and prescription pills everywhere. And here's the thing, nobody really knew what to do about it. The federal government had some old laws on the books, sure, but they were scattered, inconsistent, and frankly, not working.
So this was the moment when America decided to get serious about drugs.
This was the moment when America decided to get serious about control. I'm Sarah.
And I'm David, and this is 100 Laws That Shaped America.
Today we're talking about the Controlled Substances Act of 1970, Public Law 91513, signed by President Richard Nixon. And David, this is one of those laws that still governs our lives today in ways most people don't even realize.
How so?
Every time you hear about marijuana legalization debates, every time someone gets arrested for drug possession, every time a doctor hesitates to prescribe pain medication, it all goes back to this law. The Controlled Substances Act created the framework for how America thinks about drugs, classifies drugs, and punishes people for drugs, and it's been shaping our criminal justice system, our healthcare system, and our society for over 50 years.
Okay, so take me back. It's 1970. What was the problem that made this law necessary?
Let's set the stage. It's the late 1960s, early 1970s. The country is being torn apart by the Vietnam War. Young people are protesting in the streets. The counterculture is in full swing. And drugs? Drugs are everywhere.
But drugs had been around before, right? What made this moment different?
The scale, David. The sheer scale. You had marijuana use skyrocketing among young people. You had heroin epidemics in urban areas. You had LSD and other psychedelics becoming symbols of rebellion. And here's what really scared people. It wasn't just happening in back alleys anymore. It was happening in suburbs, on college campuses, in middle-class homes.
The drug problem had become everyone's problem.
Exactly. And the federal government's response up to that point had been scattered and ineffective. You had the Harrison Narcotics Act from way back in 1914. You had the Marijuana Tax Act from 1937. You had various other laws, but they were all separate, all enforced differently, and full of loopholes.
So what happened? How did we get from that mess to a comprehensive drug law?
Well, Richard Nixon had made Law and Order a centerpiece of his 1968 presidential campaign, and when he got into office, he wanted to deliver. But here's what's interesting, and this gets lost in the history. The Controlled Substances Act wasn't just about cracking down, at least not on paper.
Really? Because when I think about Nixon and drugs, I think about the war on drugs, getting tough on crime.
And you're not wrong. That's definitely part of the story. But the law itself was actually more complex than that. It was designed to do several things at once. Regulate the pharmaceutical industry, control illegal drugs, and yes, create penalties for drug offenses. But it also included provisions for research and treatment programs.
So it was supposed to be balanced.
Supposed to be, David. Supposed to be. But we'll get to how it actually played out. First, let's talk about what this law actually did.
Okay, walk me through it. What were the key provisions?
The heart of the Controlled Substances Act is something called the schedule system. The law created five different schedules. Think of them like categories, to classify drugs based on their medical usefulness and their potential for abuse.
So like a ranking system?
Kind of. Schedule 1 is the most restrictive. These are drugs that, according to the government, have high potential for abuse, no currently accepted medical use, and aren't safe to use even under medical supervision.
So that would be things like heroin?
Heroin, LSD, and this is important, marijuana, all Schedule 1.
Wait, marijuana? Even though we're now seeing states legalize it for medical and recreational use?
Even though. And that's one of the controversies that's followed this law for 50 years. But we'll come back to that. Let me finish the schedules.
Please, go on.
Schedule 2 drugs have high potential for abuse, but do have accepted medical uses. Think cocaine, which is used in some medical procedures, or methamphetamine, or powerful painkillers like oxycodone and fentanyl.
So these are drugs that doctors can prescribe, but with serious restrictions.
Exactly. then Schedule 3 drugs have moderate to low potential for abuse, things like anabolic steroids or certain lower-dose painkillers. Schedule 4 is even less restrictive, drugs like Xanax or Valium. And Schedule V is the least restrictive, cough medicines with small amounts of codeine, for example.
Okay, so the government basically created a hierarchy, but who decides which drugs go in which schedule?
And that, David, is where things get really interesting. The law created what was originally called the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. It later became the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, and gave it the authority to classify drugs and enforce the law.
So one agency gets to decide what's dangerous and what's not?
Well, they're supposed to consult with medical and scientific experts. The law says scheduling decisions should be based on a drug's potential for abuse, scientific evidence about its effects, its history of use, and whether it has legitimate medical applications.
Supposed to. You keep using that word.
I do, don't I? But let's keep going with what the law says. The Controlled Substances Act also created strict controls on manufacturing and distribution. If you're making or selling controlled substances, you need to register with the federal government. You need to keep detailed records. You need to follow security requirements.
So they can track where drugs are going.
Exactly. The idea was to create a closed system for legitimate drugs, from the manufacturer to the distributor to the pharmacy to the patient, and make it harder for drugs to leak out into illegal markets.
And what about penalties? What happens if you break these rules?
That's where the law gets tough. The Controlled Substances Act established federal penalties for drug offenses, manufacturing, distribution, possession, and the penalties vary depending on which schedule the drug is in, how much you have, and whether it's your first offense or you're a repeat offender.
We're talking about jail time?
We're talking about serious jail time, David. Years in federal prison for distribution, even for possession, depending on the circumstances. And here's something that would become hugely significant. The law gave prosecutors a lot of discretion in how they charged people.
So this law created the framework for what would become mass incarceration around drug offenses.
It laid the groundwork, yes. But remember, in 1970, that wasn't necessarily the focus. The law also included provisions for research into drug abuse and treatment programs. There was supposed to be a balance between enforcement and public health.
But that's not how it worked out, is it?
No, David, that's not how it worked out. Let's talk about the impact.
Yeah, because I'm guessing the reality was a lot different from what was written on paper.
Here's what happened. The Controlled Substances Act became the foundation of federal drug enforcement in America. And over the next several decades, the emphasis shifted more and more toward punishment and away from treatment.
The war on drugs.
The war on drugs. Nixon actually declared that phrase, war on drugs, in 1971, just a year after signing this law. And what followed was a massive expansion of drug enforcement. More DEA agents, more arrests, longer sentences. And here's the thing, it didn't fall equally on everyone.
What do you mean?
The enforcement of the Controlled Substances Act has been deeply unequal. Study after study has shown that while drug use rates are similar across racial groups, Black and Latino Americans are arrested and incarcerated for drug offenses at much higher rates than white Americans.
So the law itself might be neutral, but the way it's been enforced
has been anything but. And that's had enormous consequences. We're talking about millions of people incarcerated over the past 50 years for drug offenses, families torn apart, communities devastated. And for what? Drug use hasn't disappeared.
So the law didn't solve the problem it was supposed to solve.
Well, it depends on what you think the problem was. If the problem was drug use, then no, it didn't solve it. If the problem was lack of control and regulation, then yes, it created a system, though whether it's the right system is very much up for debate.
What about the pharmaceutical side? You mentioned that was part of the law too.
Right, and that's had its own complicated legacy. The Controlled Substances Act did create more oversight of the pharmaceutical industry. Doctors can't just prescribe powerful drugs willy-nilly anymore. Pharmacies have to keep careful records. That's prevented some abuse.
But
it also helped create the conditions for the opioid crisis. See, when the law put drugs like oxycodone in Schedule 2, it signaled that yes, these drugs are powerful, but they're also legitimate medicine. And pharmaceutical companies spent decades convincing doctors these drugs were safe to prescribe freely. The regulations were there, but they weren't enforced strictly enough to prevent millions of people from getting addicted to prescription painkillers.
So we have this comprehensive drug law, but we still ended up with a massive opioid epidemic.
We did.
And when the government finally started cracking down on prescription opioids, many people who were already addicted turned to heroin or fentanyl, which brings us full circle back to Schedule I drugs and the criminal justice system.
This is a mess.
It's complicated, David, and it's ongoing. Because here's the thing. The Controlled Substances Act is still the law of the land. It still governs how we regulate drugs in America today.
But things are changing, aren't they?
I mean, marijuana is legal in a bunch of states now. That's one of the most fascinating developments. Marijuana is still a Schedule I drug under federal law. The government still officially says it has no medical use and high potential for abuse, but states have been legalizing it anyway, first for medical use, then for recreation, and the federal government has mostly looked the other way.
How is that even possible? How can something be illegal federally but legal in states?
It's a legal gray area. Technically, federal law supersedes state law. The DEA could, in theory, raid marijuana dispensaries in states where it's legal, but recent administrations have chosen not to prioritize that. So we have this weird situation where you can legally buy marijuana in Colorado, but you're technically violating federal law.
That's wild. So is marijuana going to be rescheduled?
There's been talk about it for years. Medical researchers point out that marijuana does have medical uses. It helps with chronic pain, nausea from chemotherapy, epilepsy. So by the law's own criteria, it probably shouldn't be Schedule I. But rescheduling requires action by the DEA and other federal agencies, and it's a slow political process.
So 50 years later, we're still arguing about how to classify drugs.
We are. And it's not just marijuana. There's growing interest in the medical potential of psychedelics like psilocybin, magic mushrooms, for treating depression and PTSD. Those are Schedule I, too. So we're having the same debates we had in 1970. What makes a drug dangerous? Who gets to decide? Should we focus on punishment or treatment?
So what about the treatment side? You said the original law included provisions for treatment programs.
It did, but that's been chronically underfunded compared to enforcement. We spend billions on drug enforcement, DEA agents, prisons, border security, and far less on treatment and prevention. Some people argue that if we'd invested as much in treatment as we have in incarceration, we'd be in a very different place today.
So looking back over 50 years, how do we evaluate this law? Did it work?
That depends on your metrics, David. The Controlled Substances Act did create a unified federal system for regulating drugs. It did give the government tools to go after drug traffickers and regulate the pharmaceutical industry. Those were real accomplishments.
But
it also helped fuel mass incarceration. It's been enforced in racially disparate ways. It's classified some drugs in ways that don't match the scientific evidence. And it hasn't actually reduced drug use in America. It's just changed which drugs people use and where they get them.
So it's a law that accomplished some of its goals, but created a whole bunch of unintended consequences.
That's a fair way to put it. And those consequences are still playing out today. Every time you hear about criminal justice reform, about the opioid crisis, about marijuana legalization, about addiction treatment, you're hearing echoes of the Controlled Substances Act.
It really is still shaping America.
It is. And here's what's interesting to me. We're at a moment now where there's growing consensus that we need to rethink our approach to drugs. People across the political spectrum are questioning whether incarceration is the right response to addiction. States are experimenting with legalization and decriminalization. There's more focus on treatment and harm reduction.
So maybe we're finally finding that balance between enforcement and public health that was supposed to be in the original law.
Maybe. Or maybe we're recognizing that the framework created in 1970 doesn't fit the problems we face in 2024. Either way, the Controlled Substances Act remains the foundation we're building on, or trying to reform.
The law that declared war on drugs.
And in many ways, declared war on our own citizens. The question now is, what do we do about it? Do we reform the law, replace it, or just keep muddling through with this patchwork of federal prohibition and state experimentation?
I don't think we have the answer yet.